You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Yousef Manner. On his piece in The Nation, there is only one way to destroy ISIS. Also on the program today, the stupid running deep throughout the country, ladies and gentlemen, as the Tennessee GOP, one of the top leaders of the Republicans in Tennessee, calls for rounding up all the Syrian refugees in Tennessee and sending them somewhere else, apparently. And liberals for nuance say liberals are responsible for right-wing Islamophobia. Meanwhile, Bobby Jindal, sadly, leaving the presidential race, having achieved all he wanted to achieve. The 17 people who supported him are convinced that he is not a Muslim. Therefore, mission accomplished for him. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders set to deliver that much anticipated speech on socialism tomorrow. And Hillary Clinton endorsed by the SEIU, the union that has brought the fight for 15, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton only supports a $12 minimum wage. Meanwhile, back on the clown car, Ben Carson has a tough time learning foreign policy, according to his chief foreign policy aide, who, according to Ben Carson, is no longer his chief foreign policy aide. And Kasich out of Ohio comes to Jesus and Moses, inhaling our Judeo-Christian values. I don't know. That's basically like him saying, nobody was listening to me, so I had to say something. And a blockbuster story on the heels of that story about how much money the Koch brothers spent in the Joni Ernst race, Senate race. Apparently, it's now revealed that they have their own spy organization, and it is large. And also, apparently, that Frank Luntz has been on their payroll while being on CBS, espousing pro-Koch brother, I don't know, I guess, what would you call it, propaganda? Or just
propaganda.
I mean, you know, technically speaking, you really shouldn't even talk about them without revealing it. You shouldn't even be criticism. I mean, it's hard to imagine you take $1.5 million from them and then be critical about them. Now, I personally, I would do that. In fact, I would do that for $1.2 million.
I would do that for $100,000.
You know what? When you start to try and undercut me, it works out badly for both of us, because I would have kicked you 125 if I had gotten 1.2. Oh. And then I'd be sitting around with $975,000 and probably Kelly and Matt knew Matt would get a little taste too. Well, but now you've just basically sold us all down the river.
60-40.
So that you get your $100,000, 60-40, you end up with 60. Michael, that's what is holding you back.
And this country back.
Well, I mean, we will.
Remember what Donald Trump said about Frank Luntz?
I don't, actually.
Well, it was
ethically and follically challenged? What was it?
That's what you said.
Oh, that's what I said.
I don't think you'd be as subtle. But he said that he pointed out that Frank Luntz was a loser.
Right.
And that he had begged him for business.
Right. Well, apparently the Koch brothers said yes.
There you go. That's what I'm saying.
Well, we got an extra $1.5 million sitting around here somewhere, for gosh sakes. New news on the, and again, you know, we're not going to spend too much time giving straight news reports as to what's happening in Paris and in Europe in terms of the apprehension of the people involved in these attacks on Friday. Not the least of which, because you can find it, it seems to be every 12 hours there is a new update, at least, to this story. But you can find it much easier online. And my guess is that by the time that we have reported it, it's already changed. But two died in Paris last night as Parisian forces, counterterrorism forces, basically assaulted an area where seven were arrested, two were killed. One who I believe set off their own bomb or was, you know, some type of suicide vest. I believe she was a woman. I'm not 100% sure about that, but this is just coming in. You know, it's ongoing, obviously. But we will talk to Youssef Manner about his piece. There's only one way to destroy ISIS in just a moment. It appears in The Nation magazine. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Youssef Manner. He is the executive director of the U.S. campaign for ending the occupation in the Palestinian territories and a policy analyst at the Arab Center, and also has written a piece in The Nation magazine, There's Only One Way to Destroy ISIF. Youssef, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
So let's, you start your piece with a analogy about counterterrorism strategy, a boiling pot analogy. Walk us through that, and then let's talk about how that applies in the context of ISIS.
Sure. Well, you know, I've always thought that the best way to think about counterterrorism strategy is this boiling pot analogy, and I would encourage your listeners to think about the situation where one is confronted with a boiling pot of water and then facing the challenge of preventing any bubbles from rising to the top. Now, there are a couple ways that you can go about meeting this challenge. You could attempt to individually destroy every bubble before it reaches the surface. You could attempt to disrupt these bubbles before they can even really make it halfway up or at the very early stages of their formation. But that becomes difficult to do over time because as the heat rises, more and more bubbles are created. Your counter bubble capabilities, if you will, are limited. And eventually, a bubble is going to get to the top. And of course, we know that when a terrorist attack happens, the costs of a terrorist attack are far greater than a bubble rising to the top of a boiling pot. The other pathway towards solving this challenge is finding a way to turn down the heat below that pot of water, essentially resolving or dealing with the conditions that help generate terrorism. And in the case of ISIS, really one of the major conditions that led to the creation of ISIS, the development that really made the fertile ground available for ISIS to rise was, of course, the destruction of the Iraqi state during the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the subsequent dismantlement of the state. And then, of course, the Syrian civil war, which has led to a very large, vast space that straddles Syria and Iraq, which is essentially ungoverned. And became ungoverned and was filled by ISIS, what became ISIS. I think it's important to remember that, you know, we often talk about ISIS and Al-Qaeda as if they're these entirely separate things that generated from completely different places, but the core of ISIS was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it was something that developed in Iraq during the insurgency, during the American occupation, found its way into Syria in the vacuum that was created in the Civil War, and then developed into what we now know as ISIS. And of course, went back into Iraq and took over swaths of territory between both countries. There's really only one way to resolve this issue, which is the point that I tried to make in my piece, and that's, you know, not simply through airstrikes. Because, you know, this problem developed because you have this ungoverned territory, this vacuum of power. And what needs to happen is that that space needs to be reoccupied by sovereign authorities, and in this case, a Syrian authority and an Iraqi authority, that can bring order to that space once again.
All right, let me stop you there, and we'll work back up to that point, because just give us a sense. I mean, because, you know, one of the problems, I think, in terms of that notion that I think it's clear, and President Obama was making this point over the past 2 days, which I think was actually a very good point, is that we could theoretically, right? I mean, and I don't know who we is in this scenario, but a broad coalition of forces could theoretically, with air support, enter into that area, fight a war. I guess we would get back to sort of some semblance where, at the very least, in Iraq, and maybe it would be a little bit more complicated because of the myriad of different parties involved in Syria, we could, through direct military action on the ground, I guess, beat back these forces or make them recede into the population, but we would have to stay there, right? And so and you're suggesting, at least in the context of Iraq and Syria, that there needs to be sovereign forces there. On the Iraq side, let's just take that for a moment. We know, or at least I've read, that some 90% of ISIS in Iraq are Iraqis, and presumably these are those people, or at least the core, comes from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which in many respects sort of came out of the de-Baathification, the Sunni Baathist generals and leadership of Saddam Hussein's army, or different forces, I should say. And so who could that sovereign be in Iraq if not the Shia who sort of gave rise to the, I guess, the context which gave rise to ISIS. In other words, the, you know, had there been sort of some effective power sharing, or had there been a capacity for power sharing, and maybe there isn't, and that's part of the problem with that, with the U.S. invasion, then you would not have seen perhaps that rise of what we now call ISIS in Iraq. Who could that sovereign be?
Well, look, I think there's really two ways to go about it, right? We can talk about restoring a central government in what were the previous territorial borders of the Iraqi state, the same borders of the Iraqi state under Saddam, for example, or we can talk about some form of partitioning, right? But the notion that partitioning Iraq is in any way going to be less conducive to conflict generation, I think, is misguided. I think that only sets you down a further path of conflict. This is not an easy problem to solve.
Right.
And I think that needs to be understood. It needs to be understood that this is a very difficult problem. It is going to take a serious American engagement, mostly on the diplomatic side, not on the military side. And it's going to take some serious introspection into the disaster that was the policy choice of going to war in Iraq, because there's a lot of lessons that need to be learned from that. Unfortunately, it seems many people who are talking about this issue today refuse to want to learn. You pointed out that the president said, you know, we would have to go in on the ground and reoccupy that territory. Look, the thing is, we did that in Iraq for 10 years.
Right.
Okay? At some point, you have to leave. Okay? And everybody knows that, including the insurgents on the ground. So they lay low and wait till you leave, and then they reoccupy that vacuum. And the other option is perpetual occupation, which not only is essentially illegal, but it doesn't work. And if you want to know how well it doesn't work, just ask the Israelis, who have been occupying Palestinian territory now for 50 years and are nowhere closer to resolving the challenge of political violence. So what needs to happen here is that there needs to be a representative government that retake this space in a way that serves the people on the ground. And it's not going to be easy. And there's a lot of challenges that have to be dealt with. And a big part of it, and you make an important point when you talk about the disaffected Sunni population of Iraq, and really Sunni populations in many Shia-dominated areas, and vice versa across the region where you have disaffected Shia populations in Sunni areas. This can be resolved in part by trying to dial back the broader Saudi-Iranian confrontation in the region, because that is what's creating a lot of the incentives for some of these players to choose conflict over compromise.
Give us a sense of how that has played out in the context of Syria, because, I mean, largely speaking, these proxy wars, I mean, and that seems to me to be, you know, there's almost like two co-concentric levels, at least, of proxy wars that are going on here. Particularly as we get to Syria, and we're talking now about the Russians and the Russian agenda that is sort of layered on top of the Syria or the Assad agenda, which is also sort of intersects with the Iranian agenda, whereas there was the Saudi agenda, which it seems to be they may have overreached in their mind in terms of helping in many respects fund what ultimately or providing funds, which ultimately ended up in ISIS, and the U.S. agenda, which also seems to be somewhat ambiguous. If you could give us just a sense of where all of those different agendas stand, particularly in the case of Syria.
Well, it's a big mess, and there's a lot of players, and there's a lot of different interests. But I think where you start is at the intra-Syrian level, where you have a Syrian government, a Syrian regime, the Assad regime, and a Syrian opposition. And the Assad regime is an ethnic, religious, minority-based regime that has governed a state which is essentially a ethno-religious majority that is not of the regime's background. So you have this Alawite core that dominates a regime that is governing a primarily Sunni state. And while there's some crossover between, it's really been about a family and a close clique to that family that has been able to dominate government and interests in Syria through a very repressive regime at the expense of the majority of the population there. And for the Assad regime, there's really, there's no way out of this at this point. But to continue to fight just to survive. That's the way that they view this. For the opposition, they too believe that there's really no way out of this but to continue to fight until there's an unconditional surrender from the regime, because they do not want to go back to a pre-Civil War day, because they know precisely how vicious the regime was in terms of their repression of civilians prior to the war, and it would be only worse in the days after if the regime was to stay completely intact. So there's that layer. The next step up is the sort of the Saudi-Iranian contest in the region. And the Saudis have viewed Syria as an opportunity to check Iranian power in the region. Obviously, this was set off by the removal of the Saddam Hussein regime, which, as evil as it was nonetheless viewed by Saudi Arabia as a bulwark against mm-hmm. Iranian influence in the region. It was the Jenga block that was pulled by the United States that caused everything to crumble. And it gave Iranian additional influence across the region that it did not previously have. Now, the Saudis want to check that, and they're perfectly willing to fight to the last Syrian to do that. And mind you, the Iranians are perfectly willing to fight to the last Syrian to try to maintain their ally in Syria as well. The next level up is the broader, geostrategic contest by bigger players. Here we can talk about the Turks, which have an interest, and others as well. But specifically in Syria, you have to take into account Russian interests, which have been on the ground and developing in Syria since the days of the Cold War. And they are quite deep, actually. And the Russians are willing to go to great extents to defend their interests there. And they've demonstrated that by now mobilizing militarily in Syria. And I think everybody knew for some time that Russian military intervention in Syria was going to happen at some point or was a possibility. And now that that's taken place, I actually think it provides an opportunity, because every Russian card in their hand has been played now.
Right.
And the Russians are facing a prospect in Syria where the longer they stay involved, the more costs that they're going to take. And they're really fighting to save a sinking ship in the Assad regime. So the incentives for them to come to the table in a way have increased.
And it seems to me the urgency of those incentives has increased as well, because now there is a sort of a broader international feeling that and correct me if I'm wrong here, but when we saw this bombing of Raqqa, it was basically the international community saying, now that France has been attacked, now that, and I guess would to some extent, Lebanon and Russia's plane being downed, there is a greater tolerance. I mean, it's horrible to put it this way, but this is, I think, the way that they perceive it. There is a greater tolerance for civilian casualties as a function of coalition bombs, if you will. And therefore, the sort of the level of urgency has increased, right? I mean, because there's like a broader license for the international community, even with their own domestic audiences, to get more, even more aggressive.
Look, prior to the last several weeks, and I think this still remains to a large extent, but each side in the Syrian civil war, the regime and the opposition, has said, back me, and that is the way to defeat ISIS. The government has said, back me, and that is the only way to defeat ISIS. The opposition has said, take out Assad, support us, that's the only way to defeat ISIS. And the French and the Russians have been on completely different sides of that that division, with the Russians supporting the Assad narrative, you need to support Assad to destroy the ISIS, and the French saying we need to support the opposition to destroy ISIS. And in the last several weeks, what we've seen is that ISIS has struck in spectacular and devastating fashion against the pro-Assad Russian government by destroying that plane in Sinai that was carrying the Russian plane, and attacking a neighborhood in Beirut, in Lebanon, that is thought of as one that is very sympathetic to Hezbollah, which is also very much pro-Assad. And they attacked in the heart of France, in Paris, in a way that was very much aimed at sending a message to the French government. So suddenly, these two major players in supporting the different belligerents in the Syrian civil war find themselves on the same side of the receiving end of violence from the civil war that's rooted in the civil war that they previously could ignore. That's not the case anymore.
Right.
And I think what they've realized is that the bickering, what essentially amounts to bickering and what essentially amounts to political posturing between the two parties in the war about what's the way to defeat ISIS by backing, you know, one side or the other, has really allowed this civil war to continue and has really allowed the conditions which allowed ISIS to fester continue as well. So what I think has to happen now is that these players need to look at the situation and say, listen, we need to find a way to bring this to an end, this civil war to an end, because as long as it continues, as long as there's no Syrian entity that's willing to take Syrian territory and govern it in a responsible way, ISIS is going to be there and ISIS is going to spread.
And I mean, in some way, it's been a game of chicken, right? Where everybody's just hanging in there because the costs are probably less to them directly. Although, you know, and just saying like, there's no reason for us to ultimately focus on ISIS per se, because we still have an opportunity for our guys to prevail at the end of this.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, it's the people on the ground, Syrian
right.
civilians, who are paying the highest cost for this line of thinking. Syria has essentially become a meat grinder, and it does not make any sense. And you know, in this situation, you have major regional and global powers that are backing different sides of a proxy war, and really, we're not seeing any signs of a clear winner here. And you know, at some point, people have to look at the situation and say, you know, the costs don't justify the potential ends here.
Right.
But that becomes very difficult to say to your constituents, if you're the opposition or the government, when you've already shed so much blood in pursuit of those aims. But, you know, at some point, cooler heads have to prevail. At some point, people have to say, this has got to stop. There's no unconditional victory here. There's no unconditional surrender here. And the players that are on the outside that are starting to get affected by ISIS now I think have to look at the situation and say we have to push these parties towards an agreement. And there has to be a realistic expectation that not everybody's demands are going to be met at the table.
Are we close?
But getting to...
Are we close to that? I mean, are we starting to see, like, you know, today, apparently, Sergey Lavrov said, or I guess this, yeah, this was today, that you've got it to the West, you've got to drop the Assad demands if you want to unite against Daesh or the Islamic State. Is that something that we're starting to see, or is there some indication that there's a deal like, okay, for now we drop our Assad issues, and you know, the Russians may say, well, and we'll deal with Assad. We promise to deal with Assad as long as we still have a client state at the end of this.
Well, I think we are closer to that than we've been in the past. I'm not sure we're close yet. But I think the conditions are starting to develop to push the players in that direction. And there's a couple of things that I would point out. Russian intervention, you know, it's very easy for the Russians to talk a big game, but the longer they're involved in Syria, the more costs are going to pile up, both in terms of what it costs to mobilize military there and also any casualties that they're going to take. And the Russian president has been able to somehow maintain strong approval ratings despite a really crumbling economy. But if Russian bodies start coming home from Syria, that's probably not going to last very long.
Does this
I'm
sorry. Does this problem migrate to Iraq if it is in some way contained in Syria? I mean, which is not to say, obviously, that it's not in Iraq now, but it seems like there is some measure of stability in terms of the battle lines. And I wonder if if Syria is somehow, at least the fighting is at least somehow mitigated, and you do not see civilians getting caught in this meat grinder in the same way, do we see some type of escalation in Iraq? Because it seems to me at that point, right, the Iranians would come in and help fight ISIS in Iraq more aggressively. But then I think the Saudis would then, yes, start to say, well, wait a second, we need that bulwark again.
Well, I think the big key here, and it's important to understand that the challenge that we're talking about is an asymmetric threat. This is a non-state actor. This isn't, you know, Nazi Germany. This isn't the Soviet Union. While the president, you know, used the language JV team, which is regrettable, we're not talking about the world's greatest power here in
right.
ISIS. If everybody effectively got together to resolve this, it can be resolved rather quickly. I just think the political will has not been there on the part of all the players because they're holding out to maximize their gains in the other moving parts of this situation. But if you are able to bring a resolution to Syria, I think you go a long way toward resolving the Saudi-Iranian contest. Which really is the key variable in solving Iraq as well. There needs to be a broader shared vision between the Saudis and the Iranians about how stability can be maintained in the region. Right now, they're on completely different, you know, in completely different universes about this. Obviously the Saudis are being driven by a degree of paranoia, in part because of what took place in Iraq and the removal of Saddam and the collapse of the Iraqi state, but also because of the Arab Spring and the uprisings that took place in places like Bahrain and places like Yemen and places very close to Saudi Arabia that really challenged the Saudi theory of government, which is essentially monarchy and legitimacy through heredity. That has to change, and that's one of the things that has to change in Saudi Arabia, is that vision about what creates stability and how you achieve stability is radically different than how many people in the region think about what needs to happen.
It seems that it's one thing to sort of put that that proxy war on hold in the context of Syria, but that doesn't necessarily, and this is not to say that, you know, ISIS, it seems clear that ISIS exists at the sort of the will or the lack of will to resolve the issue of ISIS, because it's a, it is in the context of this broader regional conflict. And I just wonder if you can resolve that, at least the Syrian civil war, and those agendas still don't necessarily go away. It's just that they are getting pressured by various other parties, Russia, let's say, United States, Europe, to resolve it in Syria. But then if it migrates back over to Iraq, you still have this broader conflict between the Saudis and the Iranians. And if it doesn't, their energies then go into that region. But let me ask in that context, why would some type of partition be more problematic than what we have now?
Well, I think most Syrians don't want it. Which is a pretty significant obstacle. That's number one. Number two, how do you impose partition?
Right.
That's got to be done on the ground as well, and that's going to mean determining where the lines are and putting forces on those lines and ensuring that the people on the other side of the line respect it. Doing that is a recipe for conflict creation. I don't know how long it would last, but the idea that it's going to be conflict free, I think, is fanciful. And with the particular situation that you have in Iraq and Syria, where you have so many interests, so many moving parts, so many ethnic identities, many people with different claims, from the Alawites to the Sunnis to the Shia to the Kurds. It's going to be very easy to see how there are going to be several players who are unhappy about any line that you draw. And part of the reason that we're in the mess that we're in the Middle East is because of badly drawn lines that were imposed on the region by people from the outside. So I think continuing to do that is not a long-term solution, and in the short term is not going to be conflict-free either.
So what can we look for? I mean, what would give us an indication that at least the majority of the parties who have been unwilling to really put a full effort into ending this civil war in Syria for hopes that their side would win? What would be an indication that perhaps those attitudes have changed? I mean, what would we begin to see?
Well, the good thing, if we can call it a good thing here, is that the parties on the ground are highly, highly dependent on outside support. Both the rebels and the government really need outside support to achieve their basic demands and to continue fighting in the war. And I think that if we start seeing the bigger players demonstrate a commitment to resolving this, then the players on the ground will have no choice but to fall in line, because their capability to continue waging the war is not going to exist anymore. So we're going to need to see the bigger players that are backing the parties, including the Russians, including the French, including the Turks, the Saudis, the Iranians, commit to ending the hostilities. There's going to have to be some sort of ceasefire that's going to be imposed. It would be wonderful to see an arms embargo and to see the parties stick to an arms embargo. and to actually then create a negotiations process for how to have a new functioning government in Syria that does not include Bashar al-Assad. And that's a tall order, but again, it's hard to envision any other path out of this.
Yusuf Manea, writing in The Nation magazine. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. As a reminder, folks, this program cannot exist without your help. You can become a member today of the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Yes, we went out and got that URL. jointhemajorityreport.com. And for just pennies a day, you can support this show. Make sure that it's here every day for you. 365 days a year, minus the weekend days, and an occasional, like, Thanksgiving or, I don't know, a day here or there. I mean, let's not get picky, folks. Come on. I don't know. How many shows have we done over the past 5 years? Oh, my God. Yesterday was our five-year anniversary. Good job, everybody. Crack team here.
Well, you weren't here.
Your microphone's not even on. I don't know what you're talking about, Kelly.
It's new Matt. It's holding me back. Yeah. You weren't here, so this is the five-year anniversary because
well,
Michael's
happy five-year
show.
Anniversary to everybody.
To Sam, mostly.
No, not to Sam. I mean, to the audience as well. We are not.
Oh, yeah, to the audience and Sam.
This is the we have done 1,834 and a half shows. In fact, no, for you freebies, it's really, we should really just say 1,834, period. Just that's it. 1,834 shows over the course of 5 years. You can do the math there, folks. 5 times 365. I mean, come on. We're doing pretty well. That's like a 75%, 80%, right? 90%? I have no idea. Matt, this is where you step in. I mean, this is one of the reasons why you got hired here, because I thought you could do math in your head.
I don't think math came up in the interview, actually.
Well, I don't know. I guess I got... You had such a good count of how many books you've ingested this year, I just assumed. So, folks, pennies a day to keep this show going. And as a bonus, as a thank you, we say, here's another 50 minutes, or here's another hour, here's another hour and 20 minutes. It depends. I mean, we try and keep it contained a little bit. Also, you can support this program by going to justcoffee.coop, COOP, and using the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off of great coffee. And you get the Majority FM blend. We get a little piece of that, too. And in fact, you can also go to your local neighborhood coffee shop, go in with a bag of the Majority FM blend, say, here, try this. Because there are numerous coffee shops around the country, ladies and gentlemen, that use the Majority FM Just Coffee .coop blend as their house coffee because it is a blend and therefore it appeals to a greater amount of people. You could say it appeals to the majority of people, if you will. So don't hesitate. Get a bag of coffee. Go into your coffee shop and say, hey, I'm not some type of weirdo, but you guys should think about using this as your house coffee.
Should open every sales pitch with, I'm not some sort of weirdo.
I
and
mean,
then you make your pitch.
I mean, I think that's important to establish right up front, because if you go nothing up and say, I'm some type
that.
Of weirdo, you're not going to be able to sell anything,
if
Michael.
If actually somebody said, I'm some sort of weirdo, I would want to hear their pitch.
Yes, but that's
depending on what they look like.
Right. But we've already established that you, the way you negotiate is you
undercut
the prevailing
your bribe
price
offers to the Koch brothers.
By
yes,
90%.
We've established that. By the way, available for $10,000.
Right. There you go.
Koch brothers.
Well, soon enough. I mean, now I know how to renegotiate your contract. Folks.
Only applies to the Koch brothers, not you.
Also, folks, If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. It's the least you can do. We can take a little money from Jeff Bezos' pocket and put it into the show. We can, as you know, we're upgrading our video, and we have, I think, very close to all the tools. I don't know where the those stickers are, but hopefully they'll show up soon. But so we're going to have all new content next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. But some of it may be pre-recorded. I will also tell you that tomorrow, Janine Garofalo will be in studio doing her annual, advice to you for Thanksgiving show. We've got to package that better, I think. But she will be here. She can't make it on the 24th when we usually do it. We're on Wednesday, the day of that people are leaving. So she's going to do it tomorrow. And so if you want, what you can do is wait to listen to tomorrow's show until next week. But I don't know why you would do that. So tomorrow, Janine Garofalo in studio. And then we'll have some new episodes for you next week. I think one of those days we may even do a tech day, even though we post the show and it'll be new to you. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We've got Ben Carson, his campaign, an advisor, saying that he's, well, let's be kind, saying that he's an idiot, more or less. John Kasich talking about his plans for a Judeo-Christian propaganda agency in the United States.
He's back.
Bobby Jindal saying, I have mission accomplished. People don't think I'm a Muslim, so I can drop out of the race. Jeb Bush saying, we can just have Christians only come into the country via a Christian meter, apparently. Tests your blood sugar level, I think it does. I'm not sure exactly how that works. And more. We'll be right back after this.